Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The producers of this podcast recognize the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present, and those emerging.
The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
In 15 minutes and 29 seconds, a knife is going to be thrust with powerful, relentless force. Sandy doesn't know this, but I know it. Everyone who watches this disturbing video knows it.
Finally finished, baby. Walking home now. How was your night?
Her attacker launches from the darkness. The shadowy figure is running hard to where Sandy would have been.
Hello, sir. What is the town or suburb of your emergency?
Mackay.
Okay, so tell me exactly what's happened with this lady.
I don't know. Her head is on top of the gutter. She's not moving. She's bleeding. Can you just hurry up? She's getting faint. The pulse is getting faint.
How old is she, sir?
Oh, man. She looks young.
A potential suspect in the murder of Sandy Blackburn has denied he ever confessed to killing her.
You ever seen him in meat cleaver?
Yeah, in the back pocket.
North Queensland Court has heard details of the brutal slaying of 23-year-old Mackay woman Sandy Blackburn.
Her former boyfriend went to trial over her death but was found not guilty by the jury.
He said he wanted to stab her.
I'm an innocent man. Have I done something wrong?
That's a strong indication of blood.
You've got the video evidence. It's there. It's indisputable.
And there's a mother, Vicky, who wants justice for her daughter, cut down just metres from the family home. I've gone back to the night of Sandy's murder and delved deep into her life to try to find out who killed this young woman and why. And I've spoken to experts about some of the remarkable evidence. They say this case can still be solved. Sandy's killer can be brought to justice.
Hedley
Bradley Thomas is back with a new podcast called Shandy's Story. His first podcast, the international hit Teacher's Pet, is unfortunately no longer available to listen to. The best you'll do is the original trailer.
Lynette Dawson was reported missing by her husband, former Newtown Jets rugby league star Chris Dawson.
I just don't believe for a moment that she left us voluntarily and then stayed away all of this time.
There have been two inquests into Mrs. Dawson's suspected murder, and despite both coroners recommending that charges be laid against a known person, the Director of Public Prosecutions believes there's not enough evidence.
Well, he was a teacher at the school. He came to the school in 1979 and took the sports coaching class in year 11.
How old were you then?
16.
He was the cool guy, the fun guy. He was literally grooming the entire class.
I've lost a dear friend and I've carried it for years. And I miss her every day. I just want justice. And I'd love her little girls to know she didn't leave them.
One of the subjects of Headley's Teacher's Pet investigation, Chris Dawson, is now awaiting trial for the murder of his wife, Lynette, who disappeared without a trace in 1982. He maintained for decades that Lynn had left him and their small children to join a religious group, and he went on to marry the live-in babysitter, Joanne Curtis, who was still a teenager at the time and was also a former student of his at Sydney's Cromer High School. It was later alleged that Dawson and others habitually abused students in their care at Cromer High in the 1980s. Former art teacher Peter Wayne Scott was convicted on 14 counts of child sex offences relating to his time as a staff member at the school during the same period in 2019. Meanwhile, Lynette Dawson's remains have never been recovered, but Chris Dawson's murder trial is slated to begin in May next year. For his second podcast, Headley Thomas took us to Bathurst and investigated the baffling unsolved disappearance from 2001 of Janine Vaughan.
Gentlemen, start your engines.
Even the weather is staying fine for us here at Mount Panorama for how long we don't know.
Police fear for the well-being of a woman in Bathurst who disappeared without a trace.
Janine Vaughan was last seen getting into a small red sedan in Keppel Street after a night out at the Metro nightclub.
Air and ground searches of an area at the foot of Mount Panorama, prompted by reports of a woman's screams, failed to reveal any clues.
Described as a ray of sunshine.
She's not the kind of person who will just disappear and not let anybody know what's happening.
Unless anybody else comes through with any information, it'll just sit there as a cold case.
The police strike force was set up to reinvestigate the case. It whittled down a list of suspects from 47 to 3. They include a former Bathurst detective who worked on the initial investigation. Another suspect, a local pharmacist who owned a small red car.
Never been in my car? Didn't know it.
Why did you tell them to cut the throat with a knife? That's a pretty graphic story, Dennis.
Yeah.
Janine Vaughan's family already knew what the coroner would find, that the 31-year-old had been abducted and murdered, and that the initial police investigation was flawed.
She was seriously concerned about her own safety.
This investigation has been incredibly frustrating, probably the most frustrating in my career.
We think there's people in Bathurst who have been holding on to secrets for some time.
Somebody must know something.
You know, I just want it to be over. I just need it to be over.
There are links in the show notes to this episode that will take you to the night driver and to Shandy's story. But today, we hear some of Headley's story. Of course, we'll begin by talking about the responsibility he feels when taking on these big investigations. But a little later, Headley Thomas will share with us the story of the unsolved crime that he and his wife Ruth live with every day.
Shandy Blackburn, she's a 23-year-old woman who was stabbed to death walking home in Mackay in 2013.
Is that an unsolved?
Unsolved, yeah.
How did the Bathurst one go? Any
really interesting leads that came out of it. And I think police are still following some of those and doing their own covert secret squirrels stuff that I'll never hear about.
But it was great.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was an amazing case involving, you know, the sister Kylie who just, you know, didn't stop looking, and, you know, it was It was hard too because
I still like the copper, and you know, I know you were insistent. You were like, everyone, just get over it. And I was like, Headley. I remember standing in my kitchen going, oh, I don't know, mate.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, what about it? Like, why
him? It was a while ago now, but I just remember one episode when you were like so stern with us as listeners going, get over it. And I was in my kitchen doing my dishes going, I can't.
Yeah.
I can't get over it. He's handsy and he's inappropriate, and he gives me the creeps and I can't get over it.
It will be obvious to listeners of this podcast series that Brad Hosemans isn't viewed with suspicion by me or by my friend, the retired judge Peter Murphy, in the disappearance of Janine Vaughan.
We've examined now thousands of pages of documents. We've had a look at every piece of evidence that's come in during the course of the podcast, and all of the evidence we've seen, I just can't see any evidence at all that links Hosemans to Janine in any meaningful way, much less links him to her murder in any meaningful way. But I've said all along that rumour builds upon rumour builds upon rumour. If rumours are swirling, then it's very difficult to disassociate what many people would have seen as bad behaviour from an entirely separate issue of what are the facts about his connection, if any, with Janine, and what facts, you know, and again, underline the word facts, point to any association between Hosemans and Janine's disappearance and murder.
In our view, one of the reasons for the failure of police to identify the murderer is directly due to the distracting focus on Hosemans.
Yeah.
But it was a great, by that stage, I just remember thinking about the craft that you had put into the podcast, and it was just a really great conversation that I was having with you, you know. It was just a great moment in the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Michelle. That's really thoughtful and kind of you to say great. That.
No, yeah. Well, here we are all these, I don't know, it's at least a year later
because
moved house, you know what I mean? And I'm picturing myself in that kitchen and I'm thinking, God, I don't remember much about why, but I just remember this passionate moment. Can we still not mention the name of the other show?
Oh, yeah, no, it's fine to talk about. We've been promoting that we've done Teacher's Pet. We just can't talk about the evidence. We can't sort of say anything that might prejudice his trial, but there's no problem in saying this is a piece of creative journalism. Yeah, there was a huge amount of pre-trial legal manoeuvring, and that, you know, is every right of a defendant to you know, ensure that he can get a fair trial. And one of his arguments was that pre-trial publicity made that harder. And that's the reason why the Teacher's Pet podcast is no longer available in Australia.
That's never happened in Australia before. Like, there's been a lot of podcasts, obviously, a lot of true crime podcasts. A number of them have led to things happening in the real world, inquests and things like that. But yours is the first one that has, like, as far as I know, been pulled from publication and led to this kind of contention. So how was that on you mental health-wise?
Well, we withdrew the podcast out of a sense of wanting to be as fair as possible, and I think that was absolutely the right thing to do. In terms of that whole period, it was tough for a lot of people, and I felt in the middle of a storm at times, but nothing like what Lynn's family had gone through. I was exhausted by the end of it, so mentally and physically, I think really fatigued. But then, you know, there was still a lot of work to do because I wanted to satisfy the requests of Chris Dawson's legal team. They wanted to see and hear a lot of the material that I had collated, and that's fair enough. They had every right to do that, subject to me observing, any obligations I had to individuals in terms of privacy. And that went along, and we got through it. And we're at a stage now where Chris Dawson's trial, as I understand it, is scheduled for 2022. There have been COVID and other delays that have put it off, but hopefully that's when it goes ahead and he does get that fair trial.
Did you feel like you were the leader of a team and that you had a responsibility to your team to sort of get them through something when the shit came down, as it were?
Yeah, look, I remember feeling an incredible burden of responsibility to try to tell the story as faithfully as I could, and to also honour, you know, the life of Lynn, and also, you know, her surviving family members, particularly her children, because, you know, they were caught up in this, and, you know, it's an incredible thing to be suddenly at the centre of a very public event, and then it escalates even further with, you know, Chris being charged with murder. So there have been, you know, over this period, I think, a lot of stress events on a lot of people. And, you know, I don't want to make this about my stress, but certainly it was intense for a while.
Coming up on Australian True Crime, Hedley Thomas shares the very practical advice he received from a psychologist who specialises in post-trauma counselling. But I want you to listen out for something that happens in the background of our conversation soon. It's something I found particularly interesting. Hedley was sitting in his kitchen chatting to me on Zoom, and his wife Ruth was really quietly wandering around in the background the entire time, just going about her business. She was very quiet until we reached a certain point in the conversation, and then suddenly Ruth's business became quite noisy. I didn't say anything because I found it fascinating, and I wanted to see if it got quiet again when the subject changed. Thank you to patrons Cynthia Fernandez, Megan Rice, Angela Hornman, Lucy McPhail, Paul Tomchick, and Kristen Quirk.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I think the most stressful event in my family's life was in 2002 when, you know, true crime was visited upon us in our own home. And that was a shooting that, you know, caused enormous pain, emotional, mental anguish. We still to this day don't know who fired the bullets through our bedroom window. And it's something I would really like to get to the bottom of one day. But that caused, huge trouble and upheaval, and could have really completely fractured, you know, our family because of the PTSD that arose from it.
Was that related to your work?
Yes, I'm very sure that it was related to work. We had no unusual personal issues or, you know, the sorts of things that might cause that. It was and the police were very sure it was related to the journalism that I was doing at the time, involving some, you know, pretty bad bastards. And we just didn't see that kind of attack coming, four bullets fired from pretty close range, and one of them went through the window, the glass above our head in bed at 10:30 at night, and it was just the start of a spiral of distress and anguish. And for a long time afterwards, my wife Ruth and I, really worked hard to hold things together, and sometimes worried that we wouldn't be able to, because we were just responding in different ways to the aftermath of something like that.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. I'm imagining that attack lasted for seconds, but then the reliving of that, I can't imagine how you would have recovered physically and emotionally from that. You must have relived that every second for years.
Yeah. I think Ruth was incredibly strong when I was starting to lose my way, because I found that when I went back to work a few weeks after the attack at my desk at the newspaper in Brisbane, I'd pick up the phone or answer emails from people who were contacting me because of the fact that I had been attacked as an investigative journalist. They thought that I must be really effective and would be able to resolve the issues that were plaguing them or their businesses, that I would really get my teeth stuck into something. Whereas I had concerns for the safety of Ruth and the kids. Children were very young, and I was, possibly selfishly just not wanting to have that sort of contact. And then for a period after that, whenever somebody would ask about the shooting, and it could just be a friend, it could have been a very dear friend, just, checking on welfare and asking how things were going, I would just involuntarily start to tear up, and I would find that there would be, tears just rolling down my cheeks. That would be really embarrassing, because it would happen in meetings with the boss. It would happen just out over a drink, and I wouldn't start heaving and crying or anything, but my eyes would just flow. And I realized at that point that, something wasn't right and we needed to get some help. And that's what happened. And it started a recovery period that was, difficult, but very effective.
Yeah. Police who have lived through PTSD and been retired because of PTSD, which you haven't, by the way, we should note, they talk now about the fact that PTSD recovery and counselling related to that is different. It's very specific. You can't go to a psychologist out of the phone book or whatever for PTSD. Did you find that? Did you have to have very specific PTSD counselling? And if so, what did it entail?
Yeah, well, I remember it started after a meeting at the offices of News Corp in Holt Street, Sydney, and I had gone with Ruth to see some colleagues there, and Lachlan Murdoch asked us to come up for a meeting, and we were talking to Lachlan and John Hardigan, who is the CEO, and they were keen to know how we were getting on, and telling us how they were thinking of us and how proud they were that we were sort of pushing through. But they didn't know what was really going on, because we hadn't disclosed, the troubles. And then when, Lachlan saw how just his gentle questioning about this produced this tearing up effect in me, I think he and John realised that, we needed to get some help, some counselling. We hadn't had any to that point. And I think it was John's recommendation, a really fine psychologist who was very down to earth. She was very frank. And she said to me that she had treated many police and fireys and ambulance officers who had PTSD, and that if I were not careful, I would end up like a lot of those people who she got to too late, who had failed in terms of a recovery, who had lost their careers and then been, doubly scarred by it. And her advice was, we need to get you mentally well again so that you can get back on oars and get through this. And the major piece of advice as part of that was to every day raise my heart rate through really vigorous exercise so that your brain was getting those feel-good chemicals and they were overcoming the, you know, the things that were making me feel sad and depressed. And so I just went swimming, just did lap after lap in the centenary pool and whichever Olympic pool I could get to, sometimes early in the morning. And yeah, I did that for months, and gradually it just made things so much better. I just felt less depressed, less sad, and I got physically a lot fitter. It was probably the fittest I'd been. As soon as I got better, I started eating Big Macs again.
But that's interesting. So it wasn't about gentle strolls. It was very specifically about really getting that heart rate up.
Yeah. And sustaining an elevated heart rate for, you know, 35, 45 minutes so that you are just producing neurologically whatever the brain does to really overpower the sadness. And it started to work.
Wow, no one else has talked about that. That's fascinating. That's excellent advice. Because I knew there were very specific things about PTSD that were different to general counselling around anxiety and stuff like that. Thank you.
The tearing up continued for years, but it was manageable. So it didn't suddenly stop when I got mentally and physically fitter through, you know, that sort of exercise. But I was just able to deal with it better. And you know, I think that it made all the difference.
Most importantly, though, what about the intimidation? I mean, clearly that was a very extreme message that someone was trying to send you. It can't have been a one-off. I mean, you're saying that you still don't know who did it, but you must have known who ordered it, who was behind it.
Look, the problem was I had been doing a number of stories involving different groups and individuals who had the motive to send that sort of message. And I think that those individuals, several of them, you know, certainly were capable of it, but evidence, it was thin on the ground. And so here we are 19 years later. In fact, the anniversary of it is only a few days away. And it's one that, you know, I used to sort of think about a lot more in the early years. Now, I can't believe it was 19 years ago that it happened. I've occasionally looked at the photographs that were taken of my wife and I sitting on our bed, and there's this, you know, bullet hole with the, you know, the glass splinters and so on. And I recognise, you know, the old pillowcases and bed sheets and so on, and you just think, geez, you know, if only my wife or I had been in a different position, sitting up, getting into bed, getting out of bed, you know, that would have been a tragedy. Now, I don't think the shooter intended to kill me or hurt a member of my family, but it was done with such callous disregard and recklessness that could have happened.
Oh, God forbid one of the kids wandered in to ask for something or whatever, as they do. Was that where it ended, the intimidation?
Yeah, there were no follow-up attacks.
I mean, mind you, that is terrorism, isn't it? The point of it was to terrorise you for a very long time. So
yeah, it did. And, you know, certainly I was wary for a while about the sorts of stories that I should take on. We thought about leaving our house, and there were opportunities available to move elsewhere with the company, even overseas. But I think partly because of the advice we got from the psychologist, we decided that it was best for us to stay in this house where you know, we had been raising our children, a house that we loved in a suburb that we felt very comfortable in, and we're still there now.
Mm. That is extraordinary, Hedley. Have you ever had any, does it reemerge? Does it do things, triggers, I guess? Do you get triggered by things, or any of you?
I'm not getting, I think, triggers in relation to that event, Unless someone specifically asks me about it. And the last time, and it's okay. It's okay because I know when I start to lose composure, and it's not happening now. So clearly I'm feeling in a better place about it. But it's always in the back of your mind that unhinged people can do very serious damage, and that just a split second of reckless, vindictive behaviour could change a young family's life or anyone's life irrevocably forever.
Did it strengthen your relationship, do you think?
It did ultimately, but it put a huge amount of strain on us. And, I think we could have lost it several times. My anger, really serious anger over what had happened, spilled into, our relationship. And, I think it was just a credit to my wife that she was able to manage that through this period before we got the help that was needed. And then we've been pretty good since. Very good, actually.
Yeah. But what happens now? So say today we've talked about it and the anniversary comes up in a couple of days. Will there be reaction?
No.
And also I know that she's been wandering around too. So, will there be a ricochet, do you think?
I don't think so. I think we won't mark it. I'll probably mention it on the day, but in a sort of an offhanded way, like, can you believe it's been 19 years? I've thought about wanting to revisit it myself to try to investigate what happened, to try to get the police files and see what else they possibly followed up to see if there's any evidence. I've considered that, and a little voice in my head has said, no, let sleeping dogs lie. And I have put it away, but who knows? I might get to a point where I just want to try to discover the person who did that.
Because the voice in my head, Headley, says, what a great podcast. Isn't that ironic that you actually have extraordinary unsolved?
Mm. Yeah, I am.
Is that what attracts you to them?
Maybe.
I mean, we're all attracted to them, and attracted is a gross word to use, but you know what I mean. They are fascinating, and for a journo, they're really meaty stories. Mm. But, they must be extra purposeful for you.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe at a subconscious level I am attracted to unsolved in part because of this one. I don't know. Certainly I was writing about murder and unsolved cases before the attack, so this may have just contributed to the interest that I've got in it. My wife thinks I just like the sound of my own voice.
We all like the sound of your voice, to be fair. It is a very nice voice. Do you think, did it give you extra empathy afterwards? Did it change the way you approached reporting on it, or the way you dealt with people?
Yeah, I hope that it did give me a bit more empathy, because you do need that in spades when you're dealing with families who have lost a daughter, a sister, a wife. I think journalists, because we're pretty hard bitten, can occasionally be a bit brusque or less feeling for the pain and distress that the people we're interviewing are in. Having your own experience, albeit on a very minor scale compared with Shandy Blackburn's mother's been through, or what Janine Vaughan's family's been through, what Lynn Dawson's family have been through, missing her all these years, is a help. But, you never really could possibly compare that with what they have had to endure. But it must help. It must help to shape the way you approach and measure the questioning. I think there's got to be a build-up. I don't think it helps to just, be like a bull at a gate and charge in, especially when you have such a long story to tell, and you just want to approach it as tactfully and carefully as possible.
You can't ever compare victims, can you? Your situation is different to everyone else's situation. It is different to Shandy's and it is different to Lynn Dawson's families, and everyone's situations are different. But I think that you must have come back to work with a very much deeper understanding of, on a heart level, if I may use such a kooky expression, but of just that feeling of powerlessness and loss and sort of grieving, I guess, of what you'd lost that night in those seconds when somebody fired bullets through your bedroom window. I mean, you know, what you lost in your relationship, what you lost in yourself, you know, and it feels like when you're tearing up, it feels like sort of a grieving process. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And, you know, I'm hopefully thoughtful and kind when I'm talking to victims' families and siblings and parents and so on.
Mm. But me too, but I think I'm guessing where I think you're probably more knowing.
But I think you've also got to be a Rottweiler when it's necessary, not with the families unless you suspect them.
But
you know, you've got to be tough and rugged and be able to sort of switch into the, you know, very relentless and deliberate, focused questioner, especially if you think that someone is lying or hiding something. And you need to push. So, you know, having the capacity to do that is essential in this kind of work.
Did you ever lose that, do you think, when you were in the throes of PTSD? Did you ever get scared and not have that capacity?
Yeah, no, I think when it was really bad, I wanted to give journalism away. I thought that, you know, what would be the future? I didn't want to write what I would have regarded as the sort of soft stories. I was a hard news reporter. I'd worked overseas as a correspondent in London. I'd spent 6 years working in Hong Kong leading up to the handover and through that. And, you know, I'd tried to be a serious journalist. So if I couldn't practice serious journalism because of the shooting, if I felt that I was intimidated and worried about doing that, then the options in journalism for me just seemed pretty unattractive. And therefore I thought, well, what am I going to do instead? You know, I don't even have a university degree.
Yeah, you're not going to do puff pieces on Dancing with the Stars. I mean, that's not your go.
Well, as my family would tell you, Michelle, my knowledge of popular culture is just so pathetic. I know who you are, though.
Thank you, only because we stalked you for so many months and years to get you on our show. Well, I'm glad you overcame it and went to see the psychologist and got help. Unfortunately, again, so many police have said that you know, that's really hard for men in particular to go and get that help. So
yeah, I've got a sneaking suspicion too, though, that immersion in help can also be counterproductive. I think you must get to a point where you've got to break free, and after you've had, you know, a very helpful period of counselling and hopefully you've followed the advice and raised your heart rate every day and just got your those feel good chemicals working, then just try to let go of the help, you know, because otherwise it can become a crutch and you just start to wallow in the necessity of it all and the framework of it all. And, you know, there's an industry that is brilliantly set up to cater for people, but some people just want it forever because it's also, you know, perhaps making some people feel relevant. So there's a fine line.
Thank you to our guest Hedley Thomas and to Ruth Thomas. The links to The Night Driver and Hedley's latest podcast, Shandy's Story, are in the show notes. Thank you to patrons Hannah Clare, Nicole Rudd Ellis, Kylie Walden, Sophie, Carolyn Cook, and Sammy. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
This has been another Smart Fella production in conjunction with the Acast Creator Network.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.